Today in the studio, we have a marvelous pianist and composer all the way from Los Angeles, California, Josh Nelson. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Keith. Good to be back, man. This is an awesome day for me. Yeah, I love the studio. It's great to be here with you, man.
Yeah, you were here 3.5 years ago, I think we said.
Right.
With singer Sarah Gazarek.
Right.
And now it's just you. It's the Josh Nelson show. So let's start off with some of Josh Nelson's music.
Okay. Yeah. This is going to be a tune of mine. It's called Mint Blues. I wrote it for actually not a jazz club, but a rock club in Los Angeles called The Mint. It's been around since the 30s there. And there's a jazz jam night there on Monday nights. And I used to play this with the band there all the time. So it's written for them, the Cats. So this is The Mint Blues. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Oh, so swinging. So swinging, Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks, man. Woo, it's a fun piano to play.
Yeah.
It's got some bite. I love it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piano.
Yeah.
But you make it sound great.
Ah, thanks, man.
That tune was a blues, and, you know, standard blues would be a 12-bar form.
Right.
But you've done something different to that.
Yeah, just kind of extended it a little bit, so more melody-driven, but really the blues form is in the front half of the tune, and we got this extension on the end, which just adds a little bit of color and variety to a regular blues, and just moving the harmony around, so we're circling around the 5-chord a little bit early with some other changes. So it's in C, and you go A-flat, G-flat, then or A-flat, B-flat, G-flat, then you finally get to the G.
Yeah.
So, and it's based kind of on this shape, which is... It's like a sus with or a dominant chord with a sus in it, and it kind of moves its way through the tune. So there's a harmonic shape, and then there's this extension on the changes. But really, when it comes down to it, I still feel it like a blues, or trying to get the energy across that it is that cyclical, that 12 bar, even though it's not 12 bars. It's longer than that.
I think it's
24. Right? Is that what it ends up being? I never counted.
Yeah, it seems like the first couple, two-thirds of it is you've just doubled.
It doubled, exactly.
Doubled the
4, 12, 16, and then actually it might be 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. No, it's like a 26 or 27 because it's got the weird three-bar thing near
that.
The end. Yeah. Anyway, well, numbers.
it doesn't seem like an odd phrase at all. I mean, it's so musical that it makes sense.
Yeah, when I write tunes, if it happens to have an odd phrase, I usually very rarely set out to do it when I'm writing it. It's just the melody comes out that way.
Yeah.
And then if it happens to be a good vehicle to play over, that's great. Not every tune develops that way, but I feel like if it's coming from a strong melody, it's going to play itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can always hear it playing while you're soloing. It's always playing in the back of your head, so...
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That was great.
Thank you.
You know, earlier when we were just chatting, you mentioned Donald Brown, and I heard you play some of a Mulgrew Miller tune, and you know, this group of pianists, James Williams. And these guys from Memphis, the Memphis piano tradition, coming out of Finest Newborn.
Yes,
and I hear that in this tune so much.
Oh, cool.
I mean, there were a lot of things that I heard, like, wow, he's really influenced by those guys who I love.
Oh, yeah.
And,
me too.
And so it makes me wonder, I'm always curious, you know, so where did you start? What were some of your early influences?
Early influences for me came from the likes of Scott Joplin. I remember learning a lot of the Rags, you know, even early, like, easy solo piano versions of them. And I was like, man, these melodies and this rhythm is like killing. Mm-hmm. And I got into I started listening to like James P. Johnson. Like my dad had some old records of James P. Johnson. I was like, man, this stuff is really happening. So there's like definitely some Southern blues, and there's like, you know, some gospel in my playing, even though I didn't grow up in the region. But I grew up in local churches playing music, and Baptist and evangelical. And so there's older church music in there. And then there was newer church music, the pop kind of side of things. So that's definitely in my DNA, and just it's just all in there. And then my dad introduced me, and my grandfather as well, to Leonard Bernstein and Andre Previn, Oscar Peterson. So those were some of the early people that I remember hearing. Wynton Marsalis was somebody that my folks were like bought me a couple records, and I was like, "Ooh, this is cool." It's like a mix of modern and traditional. So those are some of my roots, especially that the 80s, 90s Wynton stuff, like Black Codes and Standard Time Volume 1. And, I mean, it was just amazing. One of my favorite pianists that I have to like mention is Marcus Roberts. He's just a bad dude. This record called As Serenity Approaches. It's the solo piano record with a few duets with Wynton, Scotty Barnhart, and people like that. But it's just like, there's so much soul and groove in his stuff, but there's this slightly modern tip. And a pianist I've connected with in LA who played with Wynton and has his own thing and rooted in that is Eric Reed, who's a fantastic musician.
Oh,
and I just look up to him so much. We've gotten to know each other a little bit in LA that he's living out there now. Mulgrew Miller, in my early studies, was a huge influence. My teacher, Cecilia Coleman, loved him and loves him. And I really spent some time with Mulgrew's music and learning it and learning his tunes and transcribing his solos and just like being way into that. And Kenny Kirkland, another person that just like blows my mind every time I hear him, though he's been gone for 20 years now. What a force. I mean, as a side man, as a leader, as man, those are some of my main cats.
Yeah, I can hear it. And you mentioned the gospel thing, and I'd kind of made a note of that, a mental note too. I heard some chords you were playing. I thought, there's some real gospel happening there.
I got the chance to play with Natalie Cole, who her music was, you know, so based on pop and R&B, and she grew up in the church. In the Baptist church, her dad was, you know, Southern Baptist. And, you know, I really learned how to like settle into a groove in that R&B kind of world a little bit more on her gig. Cause I hadn't exactly played anything that unique and that special to such a special artist, you know, but getting to play. That stuff, the intro to This Will Be, you know, I was like, ooh, I want to learn how to do that. Because the music director, when I first started playing, I was like improvising it a little bit too much. She's like, no, you got to learn it off the record, play it the exact way, because that's what the audience knows. This is the tune. Play the tune, play the song. So like, oh, I got to make it feel right. So that was a different thing, you know. I got so used to improvising everything. It's like, no, not everything's going to be... It'll be still be improvised on some level because it's you playing it. It's fresh and different for that reason. But it got me into the mode of thinking parts and orchestration and the right feel and delivering the right message to the audience, especially with a tune that's tried and true and people have heard it so many times the same way.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Natalie. I wanted to really hear about what that was like touring with her.
Oh, so great. It was really a
How long
special time.
Were you with her?
A little over six years. I started with her in 2008, and she passed away at the end of 2015. I had stopped kind of the last year and a half playing with her because I was doing some other stuff of my own. And she wasn't working as much anyway at that time. Her health was starting to really impact her travel schedule. But just a magical, wonderful person and tied to the legacy of the music through not only her own music, but her father, the great Nat King Cole. I mean, and her uncle, Freddie, and just a musical family. So musical. One of the most, she could be totally sweet and gracious, and then she could turn on the fire when she wasn't liking something, you know, hey, that's
all good.
Would she
do that on stage?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
She would do it on stage. And it was just a learning opportunity. If she didn't hear something she wanted, she'd kind of throw a little tantrum or something, but no one cared because it was, you're just getting the Natalie treatment. You're getting her, the whole world, you know? So, I mean, really there were not a lot of times that happened. Most of the time she was very gracious and lovely. And we just wanted to play well for her huge book of music. I mean, I think I had 800 songs, in my folders. Yeah. I mean, you're talking somebody who went mid-70s to the mid-2000s. It's like a 40-plus year career, just an incredible amount of music. And she'd do her regular tunes a lot, you know, maybe the same 20 or 30 tunes, but then she'd pull out one once in a while, and you're like, wow, this is a great tune. Usually like an old R&B tune from the 70s that I was like, wow, okay. So she just had so many tunes in her head. And she remembered all the lyrics to most of them. Near the end, she would start to mix up some lyrics here and there. But I'm like, wow, that you can even keep them like straight. Just incredible. She'd always tell us stories about her dad and Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald coming over to the house and like hanging out. Charlie Chaplin giving Smile to the song Smile that he wrote, of course, to Nat. And she was like right there when it happened. Like Charlie Chaplin came over to their house and right 5 minutes from where I live in LA now. And yeah, I want you to sing this. And like, wow, part of history.
Whoa.
Just, she was there. That's she was moment. Witnessing it. Yeah. Not many singers of that kind of ilk and generation are around anymore. That's kind of a major, major loss for me when she passed, because we became pretty close. And if you were playing with her, you were like family. She treated you like a family member, and she brought turkey dinner all the way from the U.S. to Tokyo for a gig once. She packed her bags. She made food and packed turkey dinner for the band and opened it at the club. And we're like, what? Are you crazy? And she was just like, I wanted to do this for you guys. Like, just a really cool lady. And very home-based, very faith-based. She had strong religious upbringing and strong religious values and moralistic and just beautiful woman, really beautiful woman.
That's great to hear. I mean, you know, you hear interviews, you see people perform, and you like to think they're a certain way, and then you hear that they're not.
Right, right.
So it's great to hear that she really is what you know, you perceive.
Yeah, and, you know, I caught her towards the end of her life. I think probably there were some moments earlier on where she could maybe lay it on a different way, but all good. It's all part of it.
Yeah, yeah. So you have so many influences, and I'm guessing you probably were influenced by classical music in some way.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, I listen to a lot of classical music and have been live and on records since I was a kid. Again, have to give, you know, props to my grandfather on my mom's side and my dad and my mother. You know, just they're fans, so I became a fan because that's what they had on in the house. And so I spent a lot of time listening to Dmitri Shostakovich, Aaron Copland, Samuel Barber, Charles Ives. Definitely, you know, Beethoven and Brahms and Chopin and all the greats in there. But I think my dad and grandfather favored more modern Debussy, Rachmaninoff, you know. So you can definitely hear it in my playing on certain tunes and writing when it comes out. And I just have so much respect for, like, the classical music world and classical pianists that spend so much time getting the stuff together. It's such an inspiration. I never really delved deeply into the classical piano, you know, repertoire and literature, but have done a little bit, and it just boggles my imagination how not only these composers wrote this beautiful, intricate music, but then a whole generation or multiple generations of players have been interpreting it for so long and bringing their own thing to it. It's such a deep, deep well. Amazing. So I am influenced by it greatly. So one of the pieces I wrote that appeared on a record from 2009 called I Hear a Rhapsody is a piece called Lullaby for Ludwig. And I kind of based it a little bit on a little bit of a Chopin Polonaise kind of vibe. But there's some ragtime in there too. You'll hear the key change and the kind of the bridge and the trio return form. And this is for a friend of mine who was unfortunately hit by a drunk driver about 12 years ago in Los Angeles. Very talented Swedish violinist who was taking LA by storm. Everyone wanted to play with him. He was one of these guys, went to Berkeley, perfect pitch, could play jazz, could play classical, everything in between. Just a genius. He's actually still alive, but not himself really anymore. So this song reflects kind of the longing of missing Ludwig, but also remembering about him, about his quirky humor and fun times we had together. So I'll play it for you now. It's Lullaby for Ludwig. Thank you.
That's beautiful. You're such a beautiful touch.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So here's another composition from the same record, I Hear Rhapsody. This is called A Change in the Wind, and also has some classical elements about it. The form, some of the voicings and melody lines, I feel like have a romantic, classical aspect to them. This tune on the record featured the great Ben Wendell. Sam and I played bass, Zach Harmon played drums. A Change in the Wind. Hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
That was a change in the wind. Definitely a classical influence there, but I heard a lot of Brazilian influence.
I was thinking that as I was playing it, I'm like, I think there's some Brazil in here too.
I'm pretty sure there
is. Yeah, which I feel like is more of a new thing for me in the last 5 to 10 years as I've been exposed to more of the music, aside from just the genius of Antonio or Carlos Jobim. We're all brought into that first in the jazz world.
Yeah.
But then there's so many other incredible composers. I actually just did a record for a label, and he featured the music of Egberto Gismonti, who is somebody I didn't know about until maybe the last few years. Just a genius classical, jazz, classical, Brazilian, everything in between, pianist and guitarist.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to see him while I was on tour with Natalie in Brazil. He was playing one night and we went to see him.
Oh.
And it was just, I'll never forget it, one of the most magical moments. What an inspiration. So Gismonti and Chico Buarque and Jovino Santos Neto, a great guy I met in Brazil camp. I didn't go there, but Jazz Camp West up in the Bay Area in California. And this wonderful guitarist, Chico Pinheiro, who I know has been around here maybe a little bit, who's been totally inspiring to me. I love that guy. He's amazing.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of it through, I was introduced through Anthony Wilson, the great guitarist and composer, because he has a love affair with the music from Brazil. And he really loves the music and did a record there with some great cats, Andre Mamari, and guys I didn't know about. So sometimes it takes somebody that you know to like, hey, why don't you check this guy out? You know, he's really cool. And so, yes, there is some, I heard that too, some Brazilian influence.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
And rhythmically, of course, being a drummer, I'm all about the rhythm, but, it's what I listen to first, but rhythmically, you're so free. I mean, all the different subdivisions superimposed meters and all these different things. And just so adventurous, you know.
Thanks. I'm trying to continually work on all that stuff and have it feel groovy and right, even when something complex is happening. That's always the trick to me. To never have it lose the groove. I always want that. And I know that's something you probably think about all the time.
Yeah.
Through all the technical stuff, that it's doing it for the right reasons, but to enhance something in the melody or the groove, but not get so far away that you lose yourself or you lose the audience or something, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it always has to feel good.
Yeah, that's the rule, right?
But what I like just watching you now is... I said you were adventurous, but it seems like you're really going for some things.
Mm.
And even though, you know, we as improvisers, we're going for things, and sometimes we kind of paint ourselves into a corner.
Yep.
And then how am I going to get out
of
here? And I feel like I've been able to witness a little bit of that, to see you go for some things.
Yeah.
And then you get right out of it. And it's beautiful.
Thanks, man. Well, you've heard me kind of over the years now, probably develop, you know, a few years ago, just as far as my playing. And I'm a little bit of a late bloomer as far as the actual, I feel like, piano performance thing. I'm almost 40 now, and I'm seeing, you know, these young guys that are in their teens and 20s just burning on the instrument.
Whoa,
I never had that, really. So I feel like I've just been a slow burn, like, over a longer period of time. But some of these tunes, like, that tune was written, 9 to 10 years ago. That's an older tune of mine. But there's still material to be mined from it. And I still want to find the nooks and crannies in the harmony to explore. Or even I did something on that one that I had never done before except till right now, and I didn't even plan it. It was when it cadences at the end. And then I stayed here on this B sus. And then I just stayed there and decided that it was become this Picardy thing, and all of a sudden it became minor. And then I kind of started to move it around. I was like, wow, I never thought of like hanging out there for a minute. But I love that being an improviser just allows you to just paint in the moment, especially when you're solo piano and there's not a band that you're trying to lead or make sure everyone's, you know, together. But even in the trio, I'm trying to write some more music that's a little bit more less structured so we can all talk together and just listen more and not feel that we have to always make the mark with the lead sheets or here's the form or why is it so, you know, does it have to be so clear every time? You know, not every tune it's appropriate for, but I'm just trying to get out of, you know, our bad habits or how we paint ourselves in corners sometimes. You know, we get in the rut of doing certain things a certain way. You know, jazz pianists have a certain tendency to play all their melodies in their right hand and all their comping and bass line stuff in their left hand. And I'm constantly trying to get them out of thinking about it that way, and that there's melody happening in both hands, and that you need to shift your perspective and throw the melody in your left hand, solo with your left hand once in a while. It's, we're taught that there's a right, like a right way to do it in jazz, but there's really not. It's kind of really open. So that's why I love listening to and having like classical music and film music influence my writing and playing, because you just listen to it and you can hear it. You're like, oh, this orchestrator is throwing it all around. So why should it change when it comes to the piano? I mean, yeah. So yeah. Anyway.
And as a soloist, like you say, you have so much freedom. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want, whenever right. you want. And
yeah,
that must be really nice. I mean, it's also, you know, you're very exposed.
Right.
So, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Don't
you got
drop
a bad
it.
Note in there. And there was a few clunkers.
But I didn't hear them.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, and every instrument is different. So, you know, two tunes in, I'm starting to figure out, like, remember how to play this instrument and where the louds are, where the softs are, how the pedals feel, how the pedals affect the sound. Certain instruments react differently to the pedaling, especially the soft and damper pedals, you know, sustain. So just, yeah, it always takes me a minute. Some cats can just get in and like burn. I'm like, no, I got to like meet you. It's like meeting a new person for the first time, or an old friend that you haven't seen in years. Hey, how you doing? Nice to see you. I'm going to play you.
Yeah, you don't get to travel with your instrument.
No, which is a blessing and a curse.
Right.
Totally blessing and a curse. I've played so many pianos, and I'd say it's like probably 50 or 60, 40 for like, you know, okay instruments and then really good instruments. You know, there's a lot of places that maintain great instruments, and there's plenty that instrument used to be good and it's like not happening anymore. This is a nice Yamaha though. I really like it.
Yeah. Really take good care of this.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
So you have quite a few recordings out, some as under your own name as a leader, some collaboration with people like Sarah Gazarek. Mm-hmm. But your first record was recorded in 2006,
yes.
Let It Go. Mm-hmm. What was happening in 2006, or how did you get to the point where, okay, I'm a young artist, I need to record my record? What was happening at that point?
Yeah, well, a big catalyst in making that record happen for me actually was vocalist Sarah Gazarek, who I've been friends with now for, 14 years or so. We've been making music. She had a record deal with Native Language Music, and she put out the record Yours, John Clayton produced, and that was 2005. And from that record, I got to know the label owner, Joe, really well, and he offered me a one record little deal. And he says, get who you want. I want you to get the cats who you want. And I was really into Seamus Blake at the time. Still am. Huge Seamus Blake fan. Great tenor saxophonist and composer and visual. I think he's a visionary. So I somehow managed to reach him. And I was, you know, 11 years ago, I was, you know, 28. I still felt really green in the music, even though I had already played with a few folks and had some experience, but I was pretty green still. So I was really nervous about even making this happen. Seamus is like, yeah, I'll come out and do it. Cool, man. He was really cool. And then I asked the great Matt Wilson, who is one of my all-time favorite people, even before music, but his music's ridiculous. And then I asked Anthony Wilson, who is at the time was starting to become a major influence in my life, was starting to play a little bit with his nonet and learning about his music and his father's legacy in Los Angeles, Gerald Wilson, and Anthony's beautiful world of music. And then someone I just was enamored by on the scene in L.A., Dara Coles, the great bass player from Poland. So I just asked them all, and they all said yes. And we did it in Orange County at the beautiful studio. And yeah, probably because of Sarah, that record happened, connect the dots there. And it came out nice. I still feel pretty green when I listen back to my playing on it and everyone else's, like burning all around me. And I'm like, God, that was such a cool learning experience for me. I really came away from that going, okay, here's what I need to work on in my playing. Here's what needs to happen with my tunes. There's some good music, but it also signaled some stuff for me. Like I need to continue working and developing, and I'm not done, you know, I hadn't made it yet or anything.
Right.
So yeah.
Well, let's hear something.
From you. So this is called Introspection on 401. And 401 is a freeway in Canada that I was driving on with Miss Gazarek, actually, at the time, between Toronto and Quebec City. And it was just one of those 6 a.m. drives, super moody out, kind of the sun just coming up, misty green meadows all around, and just really pretty. So this tune kind of, the melody just kind of came to me. It was just a lick. It was just one line to start with. So sometimes that's all it takes, just the one little idea. And then from there you can get to a piano and, oh, okay, now we go here and needs a bridge. And so, yeah. So here's Introspection on 401. Thank you.
Man, that was fun. It sounds like a wild car ride to me.
I know. Yeah, right, exactly. Did anyone fly off any cliffs or anything? Yeah, right, exactly. I think it's funny how pieces evolve over time. And when I've played that one, that's 11 years old, that tune. And I didn't play it for a long time. And then someone asked, she's like, oh man, you want to play that tune? And I was like, oh, cool. And then now I'm playing it all the time with my band and finding new spots to do some different things or rhythmically or harmonically starting, you know, so it was always B flat on the bridge to A minor. And then I was kind of working with some altered harmony just a little bit. And then same chord, just different bass notes, and you can open it up into a new place. And so it's not always feeling the same, and just little changes to give it some variety. And yeah, it's just become this little bit more aggressive kind of tune. I think on the record, it actually was this kind of more tranquil thing, even though Seamus is burning on it. But I had this image originally of it being a tune that was very kind of peaceful and sedate,
yeah,
and meditative. And now it's just like this. There's some definite Afro-Cuban things happening in that tune.
Right.
I love triplets, man. I could play triplets all day. No triplets all day long.
Man. They swing, man.
Yeah, right. It's the swing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that was from your first record.
Yes.
And you've had, as we said, numerous records out under your own name. And one I want to hear about, this record called Discoveries, mm-hmm. and there's so many things that are around this record and the Discovery Project, and can you tell us about that whole thing?
Yeah. So I had an idea for an album where I would kind of point thematically at things about science fiction and real science and visionaries such as H.G. Wells, the great writer. And prognosticator, and Jules Verne, also the same kind of thinker, and great thinkers like Nikola Tesla. So I was thinking I could group them all into one kind of idea and write songs for them and their ideas and other kind of not so direct, literal ideas about discoveries, but even discoveries as they could relate to you as an individual and your own personal discoveries. So that was the concept. And then I started writing music and I said, God, I wonder if we could put some visuals with this, like get some old archival footage of the old George Méliès trip to the moon. And I met with a friend of mine, actually, Sarah Gazarek's ex-husband, Travis. And we started putting together the idea for the Discovery Project. And it has since developed. That was 6 years ago. It's since developed into a kind of a full-fledged endeavor now where we curate a space visually. We build sculptural elements, and it changes depending on the venue, how we hang screens, or we have an artist, Claudia Carbiata, who comes in and will sometimes sketch while we're playing and have a dialogue with her. So the idea is that's an immersive audience experience. New music told through storytelling and different themes. So we have three different shows: Discoveries, which is the themes I just mentioned; Exploring Mars, which is taking a look at the red planet; and then the new one, which is taking a look at my hometown of Los Angeles, called The Sky Remains: Past, Present, and Future of LA. So when you see the shows live, there's a visual component, but they all have records associated with them that stand alone on their own. I've never done like a live DVD or anything like that of the show. There's plenty of clips of us playing though on YouTube. You can see the Discovery Project kind of in action.
Yeah, it looks really cool.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah. It's a collaborative effort. This is something I can't do on my own. I had the maybe initial idea, but I've grouped together an architect, and a visual artist, and a film editor and archivist to all come together, bring their own talents and ideas to the pool. And then we present this project.
Well, why don't you play something from one of those records?
Yeah.
From Discoveries, maybe?
Yeah. Let's do, I'll play a Tesla Coil. So this piece was written more through composed, kind of like Lullaby for Ludwig, where it's meant to be performed, you know, as is. There's a little improv I do at the end now because I can't help myself. But as a kid, I would go to the Griffith Park Observatory in Griffith Park, and there's a giant Tesla coil there, which is basically a big conduit for, you know, generating AC electricity. You know, Tesla's known as the father of AC power and was a competitor of Edison, actually worked for Edison for a little while back in the late 1800s. really interesting individual, predicted wireless technology before it, you know, 50 years before it happened or more. So I just wrote a piece for the Tesla coil, which when I would listen to it as a kid, when it zapped out its electricity, it always was this note or something kind of around B. So I crafted a little piece around B. So Tesla coil.
Cool. Oh, that's intense, man.
It's like a mad scientist kind of piece.
Totally.
I feel like I like thinking about Tesla when I'm playing it, because there's all these movies that have referenced Tesla in the past. I forget which movie it was where David Bowie plays Tesla. Christopher Lloyd from Back to the Future, just like crazy, yeah. You know, like 1.12 gigawatts, you know, just like stuff like that, you know. So yeah. It's this quiet energy that kind of erupts as the Tesla coil starts to fire up and then emits electricity. So that's the lick that kind of does that. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally hear that.
More classical influence for sure.
Yeah.
On that one. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Oh, thanks.
That's amazing. A lot of your music has a theme to it.
Definitely.
You're not just writing little pieces here and there,
right.
But everything is, everything is thematic. Mm-hmm. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely, it's just how I hear it these days. Before we were talking for this interview, I was thinking to myself, gosh, I really need to get out of the theme thing. It's so fun though,
yeah,
for me. You know, you look at all the composers and they're just writing sonatas and concertos and divertimento and da-da-da, and there's not really necessarily a programmatic element to it. But I'm highly influenced in my life by classic films, current films, books, art. I love writing music to the spirit of people. Like we played that song last night, Bhutto's song about Benazir Bhutto, and Peter Sellers, my favorite actor. There's so much wealth of inspiration there that I want to also point to their craft as well as mine and share that with people that, you know, maybe they don't know about them too.
Right.
You know, it's part of that discovery thing, you know? Cause when I discovered it, it was like an aha moment. I discovered, you know, Peter Sellers. I was just like, wow, this guy's a genius, you know? And to not reflect it musically seems weird to me. You know, it feels just second nature to like try and write something for him in his honor and his spirit, you know,
right.
And not trying to, again, just shining a light on the subject, not necessarily it has to be like a direct reference. You know, I'm not quoting the Pink Panther or anything in the Peter Sellers tune, you know.
Thank you for not doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Right. Mancini already covered that stuff, you know. And it probably has a lot to do with growing up as a kid of a Walt Disney Imagineer, which is just like was an amazing childhood. He started as a carpenter for Disney and went to Epcot in Walt Disney World, and a lot of his original sets are still in some of those rides there that he helped build. And then he worked his way up and became a show ride manager, which means he oversaw the installation of attractions at the parks. So he worked on, at Disneyland, he worked on Splash Mountain, Indiana Jones, the new California Adventure, the refurbishment of Pirates of the Caribbean in the 90s, and just all kinds of stuff. My brother and I got to test, and my sister, we all got to test the rides after the initial dummy tests had gone through.
Really?
We were some of the first kids to test Splash Mountain. So we were just enamored with what he did. And, you know, at the same time, watching all the Disney films and, you know, one of my favorites is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea from 1954, The Nautilus, you know, tragic heroes associated with great things and getting their dreams across. Walt Disney seems like a crazy magician to me. Whatever you think about him and his mission or whatever, he was a forward thinker. I mean, he collaborated with a German rocket scientist, Wernher von Braun, you know, and was talking about going to space and Mars in his TV show, Wonderful World of Color. Just somebody who was a big thinker, and I'm really inspired by what he did. So thanks to my dad once again for introducing me to that whole world and being inspired by just, yeah, everything there. And, you know, plans, and he'd bring home like schematics and blueprints of the rides, and my brother and I would construct our own little mini ride out of train tracks and like create like a little version of Indiana Jones at home. So we geeked out on all that stuff, and I have to say it's probably seriously worked into my psyche as a composer and
yeah,
just as a conceptualist, somebody who tries to think about, you know, those things and bringing them into the music. You know, they can coexist on their own, but I want to get the dialogue happening as much as possible. Yeah.
Well, you are.
Oh,
you
thanks
are.
For that.
Well, we're running out of time here, but I can't let you get away without playing something from your new record, The
Yes.
Sky Remains, because you have to share that with our audience. And it's been incredible to have you on the show, and people can find out more about you online, of course, all sorts of social media, but
Yep.
they can find you at joshnelsonmusic.com. And this new record is The Sky Remains. What would you like to close with?
Yeah. So this is The Stories of L.A. We're going to close with The Architect. It's a piece I wrote about architecture in L.A., but also a tribute to my husband, Jesse, who's a great architect for a firm in Los Angeles, and learning about his work and what he's doing to help shape the city and his firm's work, and preserving. They also preserve a lot of old buildings there, which is something L.A. has not been good at, so tearing down our past. So it's a tribute to just you know, architecture from the past, present, and the future.
So, all right. Yeah. Josh Nelson closing us out with The Architect.